Hydroxychloroquine, an unproven way to ward off COVID-19. President Trump stunned American doctors when he said he was taking it. The admission also surprised doctors in India, the world's largest producer of the drug.
Because most of the doctors and medical experts in the country feel that there's no rational basis for endorsing this drug.
Also today, international students graduating from American universities can stay and work in the U.S. for an extra year. Trump is threatening to end that. Even some conservatives think cutting those graduates loose is a mistake.
They're twice as likely to start businesses in the United States. They're twice as likely to invent a new product.
And London's theater district is shut down, its future uncertain.
You can't have social distancing backstage when you're in dressing rooms, when you're being fitted with wigs, when you're having your makeup done.
I'm Marco Werman. All that and more today here on The World. As countries everywhere continue to reopen, we're met with another grim numerical milestone. Roughly 5 million people worldwide have now contracted the coronavirus. The number of new cases is not slowing down either, about 100,000 reported daily worldwide. To decrease this figure, we have to respect our new routines, hand washing, social distancing, and so on. On the side of science, it's all about test, trace, test, trace. Easy to do on paper, harder in real life. We begin our coverage today here at home. As The World's Monica Campbell reports from California, contact tracing in immigrant communities in the U.S. is bringing some challenges.
It's the first 10 seconds of the call that count.
Hello, buenas noches.
Sí, buenas noches.
Hola, buenas noches. Mi nombre es Solange.
Solange Madriz introduces herself. Good evening. I'm with the San Francisco Health Department. She's reaching out to tell the caller that somebody they've been in contact with has COVID-19, and then she has to lead them through a delicate conversation about their living situation, if they can quarantine, and can they take time off work.
I would say that almost every question that we ask is pretty personal.
Trust is crucial in conversations like this, so people like Madriz are in high demand. Across the U.S., there's a massive effort to hire contact tracers, tens of thousands of them. They often need to call people in hotspots, and a lot of those hotspots are in immigrant neighborhoods.
We need to recruit contact tracers from those communities, and I think having people who are from those communities who speak their languages is crucial.
Michael Reed is an infectious disease expert and is helping lead California's tracing efforts. We spoke while he biked home through the hills of San Francisco, the end of a typical 14-hour day. Reed says some immigrants might fear speaking with officials. People like Madriz can help gain their trust.
We've undermined that trust over the last 3 or 4 years with policies that have made those communities feel very estranged.
And are most distrustful of receiving a call from anybody, particularly somebody who says they'd like to capture some of your personal data.
Hola, buenas tardes.
Madriz makes these calls over four-hour shifts from her apartment in San Francisco's Mission District, a neighborhood where nearly everyone infected with the virus has roots in Latin America. So she's calling people who might live just blocks from her and migrated, like her, to the U.S. She arrived from Venezuela when she was 24.
Being an immigrant myself, I think it helps a lot in my role as contact tracer because I have had a lot of barriers to overcome to be in this country. And so I know how stressful it is to be in uncertainty and not to know exactly what's going to happen next.
Nobody is asked about their immigration status. Still, undocumented immigrants might worry their information could get into the hands of immigration authorities. Health officials vow that won't happen. Before COVID-19, Solange Madriz spent time in Guatemala working on health issues affecting indigenous people.
Being in the towns where perhaps some of the individuals that we see here are from.
She knows many of the people she's calling might come from deep poverty and are barely hanging on in the U.S.
Not everybody will be able to quarantine because they are either experiencing food insecurity, and so they cannot provide the food for the families for 14 days. So it's important to be able to be sensitive to all of this.
Other calls are to homes filled with people, multiple generations under one roof.
You can tell that their living situation is extremely crowded, and those are the ones that you need to protect faster. Time is of the essence in this, and so we're trying to get ahead of the virus.
Along with her daily calls, she's training others on how to become contact tracers too. Just yesterday, she helped lead a session with 3,000 people on the line. For The World, Monica Campbell.
It seems like forever ago when the big immigration story was Central American children arriving alone at the U.S. border seeking asylum. They're still arriving, but since the pandemic, what's happening to them has changed a lot. Jennifer Nagda is policy director for the Young Center for Immigrant Children's Rights. What is happening to young migrants, those under 18, Jennifer, who arrive at the U.S. southern border?
So what we've seen in the past couple of months is the administration really using COVID-19 as cover to roll out the very worst of its immigration policies. And so while federal law requires immigration officials at the border to designate any children who are arriving alone as unaccompanied and transfer them into custody, we have learned that under cover of a CDC order, the government is in fact turning away nearly every unaccompanied child who arrives at our border seeking protection. We believe that they are either being turned back into Mexico, which is the route through which most of them arrive, or they are just being put on planes by our government and sent back to their home countries without a single question asked about who they are, their safety, the reasons they fled, and whether there's a parent or adult available to take custody and care of them when they get back to their home countries.
How many young migrants are arriving these days alone at the U.S. southern border?
There was a report this morning that up to 1,000 children have been turned away at our border since this policy was implemented back on March 20th. I don't know if that number is correct, but it makes sense and tracks with the number of children that we understood to be arriving before that time.
Chad Wolf, the acting Secretary of Department of Homeland Security, says this policy of expelling minors at the border has been one of the most critical tools the department has used to prevent the further spread of the coronavirus. What do you make of that?
I think it's deeply concerning, and we have heard from an awful lot of public health experts who have explained that this not only doesn't make any sense, but is completely unnecessary. We are only blocking children and asylum seekers who are arriving at our border and turning them away without any screening, whereas there have been no similar measures to stop travelers who are arriving from other parts of the world, including other hotspots. And public health experts have recognized that children can be safely brought into the United States and asylum seekers. More than 36 of them sent a letter to Chad Wolf and to others last week explaining this. And in fact, European countries, in setting up travel restrictions into their countries, have explicitly excluded children and asylum seekers from bans on travel into their countries, recognizing the importance of protecting the human rights of people who are fleeing persecution and children fleeing violence.
Jennifer, are there some even more basic things like notifying parents of their children's whereabouts and status that are supposed to happen under any circumstances? And have those been happening or not?
I think what's so frustrating about all of this is that federal law is clear that when we return children to their countries of origin, we have to do so safely. We are not only not admitting children in violation of federal law, they're being put on planes and returned without any opportunities for us to make sure that there is someone available to receive the children. It's terrifying for the children. It's terrifying for their parents. And it's deeply concerning for all of us who work with these children and who really just want to make sure they have an opportunity to be safe and to have their stories heard.
Jennifer Nagda, Policy Director for the Young Center for Immigrant Children's Rights in Chicago. Thank you for your time.
You're welcome.
The Trump administration has another scheme that's creating a lot of stress for foreigners, specifically for foreign students. The administration wants to pull the plug on a decades-long program that allows recent graduates to stay and work in the U.S. Here's The World's Marnette Fedaris.
Renan Pereira just wrapped up his studies. He now has a BA in finance from the University of Utah and was already deciding between two job offers. Then things changed.
The first company called me saying, hey, we are not hiring you anymore. And the next day, the second company called me, hey, you might not even start. We don't know what will happen.
That's something a lot of people are hearing these days. But for Pereira, who's from Brazil, it also means his time in the U.S. may soon end. That's because he's in a program called Optional Practical Training, or OPT. It lets him work in the U.S. for at least 1 year after graduation, so long as he's employed. Without a job, he can't stay.
So future right now is totally uncertain. On top of that, there's immigration issues, visa regulations that I also have to try to overcome.
One challenge is from the Trump administration. Although the government is still processing OPT applications, officials reportedly want to cut or even end the program, just like other worker visa programs, to save jobs for U.S.-born workers, they argue.
The job losses that are going on are really horrific.
Madeline Zavodny teaches economics at the University of North Florida in Jacksonville. She studied OPT and says there's a misconception when it comes to the jobs recent international student grads are accepting. They're specialized positions that companies can struggle to find qualified, trained people to do.
So it suggests that employers are more likely to hire OPT students when they have difficulty finding U.S. workers and that the program isn't increasing unemployment.
The U.S. has let international grads work in the country for decades, and programs like OPT have been expanded in recent years. Why? Because it was seen as an economic win, says David Beer with the Cato Institute, a conservative think tank.
Particularly these high-skill workers who are graduating from U.S. universities, they're twice as likely to start businesses in the United States. They're twice as likely to invent a new product. They are very productive, and they're contributing to U.S. productivity growth tremendously.
In the last academic year, more than 200,000 people were in the OPT program. Renan Pereira from Brazil says without the program, thousands of people motivated to help rebuild the U.S. economy wouldn't be given that chance.
I'm talking about people who came here to study, who came here to learn, who develop, who bring their different background, their different skills, and they help to build a better community.
But that argument might not be strong enough for a White House that is blocking immigrants in many ways and says it's focused on jobs for U.S.-born workers. For the World, I'm Marnette Fideris.
Here's something of an ethical dilemma.
Are you ready to go back to Titanic?
The grand ship that sunk 108 years ago lies about 400 miles off the coast of Newfoundland, Canada. This week, a judge in Virginia gave the go-ahead for a salvage company to try and retrieve some buried treasure, ending a years-long court battle. Opponents say the site should remain undisturbed. It's a gravesite, after all, and a monument to a tragedy. But the judge ruled that scavengers could retrieve a culturally important artifact, an artifact that was cutting-edge technology when the Titanic left port, a Marconi telegraph machine.
Marconi amazed the world by sending and receiving wireless messages 3,000 miles across the Atlantic. Since its invention, wireless has saved numberless ships and human lives from ocean disaster.
Unfortunately, the Marconi couldn't save the Titanic. We all know the story. The ship hit an iceberg, killing more than 1,500 people on board. The ship's Marconi machine may still have a record of the last messages sent and received, potentially including warnings of icebergs or outgoing distress calls. The Titanic's telegraph operators reportedly kept sending messages until seawater was lapping at their feet. The salvage company, RMS Titanic, says it will honor the ship during its recovery mission and plans to use underwater robots to surgically remove the Marconi unit, they say, with minimal damage. You're listening to The World.
The World's supporters include Subtitle, a podcast about how we speak.
All of human languages are products of human brains and bodies.
We talk with comedians, politicians, anyone who thinks about language. Alien languages, too.
If I were a sphere with 9 eyes or 9 sensory organs placed around my diameter, how would that affect things?
Subtitle. Find it wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. President Trump's admission was big news here.
I happen to be taking it.
Hydroxychloroquine.
I'm taking it. Hydroxychloroquine.
And also big news in India, the world's largest producer of hydroxychloroquine. So what does India's medical establishment make of the drug's usefulness in combating COVID-19? We reached out to Dr. S.B. Kalantri of the Mahatma Gandhi Institute of Medical Science. It's in Maharashtra state, one of the areas of India hardest hit by the pandemic.
Most of the doctors and medical experts in the country feel that there's no rational basis for endorsing this drug, either for prevention or for treatment. And the decision to take this drug is probably coming from political circles and not from medical ones.
Have you seen a shift in attitude toward the drug within India's government since Trump started promoting it in March?
The problem started a couple of weeks back when the highest Indian medical advisory body called Indian Council of Medical Research endorsed this drug for those who are at high risk of developing coronavirus or those frontline healthcare workers who are actively treating or they fall ill with coronavirus.
So Maharashtra, the coastal state in central India where you work, Maharashtra accounts for a third of India's virus caseload. Is hydroxychloroquine being used extensively there to treat COVID-19?
Yeah, the drug is being used in the hospitals, in the ICUs, in the high dependency units, and it's even being promoted as a prophylactic drug. For example, there was a news sometimes back that a lot of police personnel in Maharashtra fell ill or contracted coronavirus, and the Maharashtra government has now started a campaign and is now promoting the use of this drug in the police force as well.
Yeah, does that worry you?
Yeah, absolutely. My worry is that, well, even in desperate times, we should not abandon science. It makes no sense at all.
I know production of hydroxychloroquine is big business in India. It's crucial for malaria prophylaxis and for treatment with people with lupus. The government there has called for ramping up in production. Would you say science is being ignored in this case in the interest of profit?
The funny thing has occurred that there are a large number of patients with rheumatoid arthritis and lupus in the country, and suddenly this drug has gone out of market. So the true beneficiaries, the patients of lupus and rheumatoid arthritis, are not getting this drug. And the people who probably do not deserve this drug, well, the drug is being pushed for the treatment of a disease for which it is probably not effective.
Also, I'm curious, what do you make of the reports that authorities in Mumbai came up with a plan to administer hydroxychloroquine to thousands of people who live in slums there to see if it would protect against COVID-19? I gather that plan was shelved, but what do you think about it?
If you're just doling out this drug to a couple of thousand people, it becomes a purely an observational study. So I think it's a criminal waste of time, money, energy, and efforts. This is not science.
I imagine there's some ethical issues, too. You're going after really poor people in a slum and seeing if this works on them.
Absolutely. Picking up only a small segment of a population, which is probably a vulnerable population, also violates the principle of a medical ethics as well.
Finally, Doctor, India is getting slammed by coronavirus. How is India's healthcare system likely to hold up as the pandemic continues?
Probably in the next couple of weeks, India will have to face a dual burden. Because come July, August, and September, India has also to face a misery of what is called monsoon fevers, malaria, dengue, chikungunya, and the country is flooded with hundreds and thousands of patients with this acute undifferentiated fever. I am really worried that come monsoons, come July and August, how the Indian hospitals and the Indian healthcare system will be able to cope with this dual challenge of coronavirus and as well as its cousins, the malaria, dengue, chikungunya. And I don't know what would happen in the near future.
Dr. S.P. Kalantri teaches medicine at the Mahatma Gandhi Institute of Medical Sciences in Maharashtra, India. Thank you very much for your time and good luck moving forward, Doctor. Thank you.
The pleasure is mine too.
In neighboring Bangladesh, you'll find the world's largest refugee camp in the city of Cox's Bazar. Nearly a million refugees live there, mainly Rohingya Muslims who fled violence in their home country, Myanmar. Not only are they starting to report cases of COVID-19 in the camp, Cox's Bazar is right in the path of Cyclone Amphan. The storm is the first so-called supercyclone to hit the region in decades. Mori Rahman is a senior public health promotion officer for Oxfam in Cox's Bazar. Mori, what about refugees? Were they evacuated? Can they be evacuated?
So an assessment had been done before to identify the flood-prone areas in the camp and to take care of the existing shelters of the refugees. So if something happened tonight or if we get to hear anything bad tomorrow after doing the rapid assessment in the field, the specific team will take necessary action if there is any damages in the camp. Then people will be evacuated to the side by camp where sheltered had been built beforehand.
So basically, you've been able to move people out of low-lying areas and you'll make an assessment in the morning as to what else needs to be done. On top of all that, there's the coronavirus. What is the situation in Cox's Bazar right now with the coronavirus and how have refugee camps there been dealing with it?
you know, this is a crisis on top of a crisis. We had an emergency, and now within an emergency, there is another emergency. We started providing key messages to the community to prevent coronavirus using megaphone in the camp level. During Ramadan, for Muslim people, they really wanted to go to the mosque to pray, right? But we had taken support here from the religious leaders saying that it's fine if you pray at home. Working with the community groups made things much easier to make sure that people know what to do and what not to do.
All that cleaning, making sure everyone is social distancing, I would think in a camp of nearly a million people, that is a lot of work for humanitarian organizations.
You're very correct. We are trying to make sure that the transmission is low. We're in need of manpower because the thing is, you know, when we are requesting people to maintain social distance, then we have to make sure that they have all the essential basic requirements at home. It means we have to provide them soap, hygiene kit, food, just with the available resources. We are trying to face this situation, but we need support. We need resources.
And what about access to medical care? If a refugee from Myanmar is in Bangladesh and tests positive, what is the plan?
So we have coronavirus-affected people's treatment center by UN. If someone is a confirmed case, then they have been taken to those hospitals for proper treatment. And if there is need for isolation, then there are like other isolation centers. It's like for suspected cases. In general, for the country, of course, the situation is not under control. The cases are increasing day by day. Today, it was 1,600 plus. And for the refugee camps, since the scenario is totally different, so if there is this transmission, it will be really quick. And then, you know, it will be more challenging for us to control it.
Mori Rahman, Senior Public Health Promotion Officer for Oxfam. She's been speaking with us from Cox's Bazar in Bangladesh at the refugee camp there. Mori, thank you very much. Good luck and stay safe.
Thank you so much.
We're glad you've chosen to spend your time with us. Here's another way we can connect when we're not on the radio. Start your morning with an espresso shot of news stories from around the globe. Our team at The World will drop it right in your email inbox so you can start the day informed. Sign up for our morning newsletter, Top of the World, on our website, theworld.org/newsletters. We'll get your day started right. That's theworld.org/newsletters, and this is The World. We all need a vacation. Jamaica sounds pretty sweet, and they need the tourist dollars, but the island's tourism industry has been rocked this year by the pandemic.
The first 2 months, we had just a little over a million visitors and earned nearly $1 billion, and then since, we've had zero earnings.
Is it safe to visit? We'll hear from their tourism minister coming up on The World. The last time London's West End Theatre District was shut down was World War II, during the Blitz, when German bombs were falling on the city. After more than 2 months of London theatres in the dark during this pandemic, there's still no sign the curtains will be raised anytime soon. From London, The World's Orla Barry has our story.
One day more, another day, another destiny, this never-ending road to Calvary.
Les Mis, the longest-running musical in history, has played every week on London's West End for 35 years. But for 8 weeks now, the theatre has been dark, and the show's producer, Cameron McIntosh, is not convinced it will run again this year.
The truth is, until social distancing doesn't exist anymore, we can't even plan to reopen. I think we won't be able to come back till early next year. That's my fear.
Theatres all over London shut their doors March 16th. Producer Nika Burns co-owns six theatres in the West End. She was at a preview of her new show, City of Angels, when she heard the news.
And we were already all in their costumes, and we heard that we couldn't play. And audiences were arriving wanting to come, and we had to turn them away. It was almost unimaginable that this could happen.
That same night, Burns says she took a walk through the West End neighbourhood.
And I walked around the theatres and said goodbye to them. And I made the decision that I would keep my lights on. And I rang up Cameron McIntosh, who owns the two next door, said, will you keep your lights on? And he said, oh, darling, marvellous idea. So we kept our lights on just to remind everybody that we would be back.
Scottish actor Niamh McEwan landed the role of Otto in a Tom Stoppard play called Leopoldstadt. It was his West End debut.
And part of me was very, very sad because I love the people I'm working with at the minute. I'm working with a massive cast and I just love them. Like, we're all very close.
That night, McEwan and the rest of the cast went out for drinks. He says it felt like a wake. A few days later, they all met up over Zoom to chat about work.
We're also sharing information, going, has anyone else lost a taste of sense of taste and smell? Is anybody else feeling this, feeling that? Everybody raised their hands and we're like, right, so we've all had it. We've all passed it around each other.
Nearly all the cast had contracted the coronavirus. They've recovered, but like McEwan, most of the actors have received no income since March. A financial support scheme for the self-employed in the UK comes into effect in June, but many are not eligible. Which is why many theatres in London are closely watching what's happening in South Korea.
Sold!
And do I dream again, for now I find the
fire. Sing, my angel of music!
Andrew Lloyd Webber's Phantom of the Opera reopened in Seoul in April. Sharon Kasif, producer of Phantom's World Tour, says audience members have to take precautions.
When people come into the theatre, they have to sanitise their hands. People have their temperature taken. They try and automate the doors where possible. People wear masks. And if an usher sees somebody take their mask off, they'll go and point their torch at them like they do if they were using their phone and ask them to put their mask on.
But Kasif admits that for the cast, it's a different matter.
We haven't altered the way the show is run. You can't have social distancing backstage when you're in dressing rooms, when you're being fitted with wigs, when you're having your makeup done.
She says cast members are asked to contact the company's doctor if they feel unwell. Kasif believes the West End in London and Broadway in New York could both follow South Korea's lead if they had proper testing in place. One of Nika Byrne's musicals, Everybody's Talking About Jamie, has started rehearsals in South Korea. Burns is hoping she can reopen shows in the West End later this year. But social distancing, she says, in a theatre, that's not going to happen.
Economically, it just doesn't work out. The question for me then is, what can we do to allow people, once they're in the building, to sit next to each other in a safe way?
Burns says she doesn't know the answer to that question just yet. And she says she's frustrated that the UK government doesn't seem too concerned about the future of the West End.
No, I don't. And I find that quite shocking, given that one of our greatest exports worldwide are our theatre shows. I just don't understand how the word theatre has not popped up anywhere, or the word culture. Nowhere.
For now, the lights may be on, but the West End remains closed down. And no one can say when the show will go on. For The World, I'm Orla Barry in London.
We've all had our vacation plans cancelled, but now maybe we're starting to peek forward a little bit, allowing ourselves a chance to ask, can I safely go to... Yeah, tourist destinations everywhere are banking on us finishing the sentence.
Jamaica, heartbeat of the world. Let's go.
That's Jamaica's sparkly new ad campaign. You might have seen it ages ago during the Super Bowl. It's been a long dry spell in Jamaica since then. Plans are underway to lure tourists back safely. Edmund Bartlett is Jamaica's Minister of Tourism. Tourism is a multi-billion dollar industry in Jamaica. It drives the economy there and touches many businesses. How devastating has this year been for Jamaica, especially the job losses for people working in tourism?
Well, COVID has really put a serious damper on the tourism flow into Jamaica. The first 2 months, we had just a little over a million visitors and earned nearly $1 billion. And then since, we've had zero earnings. The implication of that for employment is that currently tourism employs 170,000 people directly. 90% of them are laid off.
Wow.
So that's about 153,000 workers that are laid off at the moment.
That's pretty stunning. Last time I checked, the number of coronavirus cases in Jamaica was around 520 people and 9 deaths. So what is the plan to get tourism back on track in a way that's safe for workers and tourists?
Well, we have been embarking on a huge program of retraining and public education. First of all, to sensitize our workers and the people of Jamaica to the importance of observing social distancing, the utilization of various types of sanitation and sanitizing facilities and equipment. What we're doing is to build a consciousness in the society of the importance of observing these protocols.
Following that international protocol, do you think that's enough to convince visitors that Jamaica is safe to travel to?
Right. So in addition to that, we have developed new protocols in relation to how we accept visitors. We're working with the airlines, we're working with the airports. At the same time, we are ensuring that all of the wonderful attractions at Jamaica are being configured to enable physical distancing and to ensure the highest level of security and safety for the health of the visitors who come to Jamaica.
Mr. Minister, can you recall ever such a challenge to Jamaica's tourism industry as this?
Never. This is unprecedented. All of us are experimenting as we try to find a way to navigate these uncharted waters of COVID-19.
Mr. Bartlett, what about you? What has it been like for you personally? Like when you traveled around the island, what were you hearing?
Well, I tell you, this has been a very traumatic experience for me. It's like a mood shift which takes you from a high to one where we have zero earning and zero arrival.
Even though Jamaica's tourism industry now has to pivot, are you also going to change your theme song? We heard Could You Be Loved earlier, but it was One Love by Bob Marley for years. Kind of hard to beat that.
Well, you know, One Love is immortal. And what we do is to have variations around love, but the central theme is love. Jamaica, the heartbeat of the world, will remain that way. We feel that great sense that coming to Jamaica gives us the opportunity to show the warmth and the real spirit that Jamaica is.
Well, I can attest to that, having been there. Edmund Bartlett, Jamaica's Minister of Tourism, thank you very much.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate this discussion.
It's election day in the East African nation of Burundi. Even during a pandemic, lines outside polling stations were long. The people of Burundi have not had a truly competitive presidential election since their 12-year civil war ended in 2005. That war left in its wake an estimated 300,000 dead. President Pierre Nkurunziza is now stepping down after 15 years in power. His legacy? Multiple accusations of human rights abuses. Kedi Nivyabandi is a Burundian poet and human rights activist. She's currently living in exile in Ottawa in Canada. Kedi, thanks for being with us. Pandemic aside, what does this moment, this election day, mean for you?
I would say it's a difficult day for me, Marco, because every election is an opportunity for a country to restart. But also knowing how much the electoral process has been flawed from the very beginning, I know that you cannot have a free and fair election without a free and fair process. And, you know, we're seeing today, for instance, social media was blocked. Internet access has been limited and blocked. There are so many mechanisms put in place to further silence and make sure that these elections are happening without any observation. And every mechanism has been put in place to ensure that the results favor the ruling party.
And in the foreground of this election is a deadly pandemic. Burundi only has a few dozen reported cases of COVID-19, I see, but it's a country of 11 million and has carried out only about 600 tests. With these long lines, it doesn't seem people are worried about going to the polls during a pandemic. Are you worried for them?
Of course I am. Of course I am, particularly because no measure has been put in place to sort of curb the pandemic. The regime has had an attitude of complete denial towards the pandemic, going to the extent that they have actually expelled the WHO representative in Bujumbura precisely because he was calling for precautionary measures during the elections. So I am concerned, of course, for the safety of Burundians, and I think many Burundians are concerned. However, they still see this as such a powerful opportunity to change. We have heard reports from people on the ground saying that, yes, they know they are at risk, but they still want to make sure that their voices are heard through the vote.
Kedi, you were forced into exile following the 2015 elections after leading protests against the president. So as you look ahead, what do you think these elections can bring to Burundi? What are your hopes?
My hope is that there would be a change, of course, of leadership to put a stop to the violence that has been ongoing for the past 5 years. But my hope really doesn't lie in the two main political candidates. I think my hope lies in the people of Burundi and their resilience, people who have managed to remain peaceful despite daily assaults. I'm particularly thinking of the women who have kept this country together and who have kept responding to the ravages that the regime has caused. The wreckage and the damage has been deep, profound. I think it will take long, long years to recover from. It's not a one-day affair.
Keddy, you've clearly got a huge stake in the future of Burundi. Are you able to vote? Does Burundi have absentee ballot voting?
You are able to vote. However, I would not be safe even to go to the Burundian embassy here. I am, of course, known for my role against the current regime. And in fact, I've had messages from even embassy officials saying that I'm lucky to be right here in Canada, in a country where wow. human rights are protected. So I would not bother to show up at the embassy, as I know that my vote will definitely be rigged. But my hope for Burundi is as alive as it ever was. And I believe that another form of governance, justice, equity, and dignity for all Burundians is in the future, for sure.
Keti Nivyabandi is a Burundian poet and human rights activist. It's great to speak with you again. Thanks very much for your thoughts.
Thank you, Marco. Thank you very much.
Polish musician Kajik was riding high last week. His song, Your Pain is Better Than Mine, topped the music chart on a state-run radio station in Poland.
Zamknięte cmentarze to na skutek zdarzeń ostatnich tygodni, ostatnich wydarzeń.
The song is widely seen as critical of the head of Poland's ruling Nationalist Party. The lyrics are about grieving during the coronavirus outbreak, while Poland's cemeteries are closed off.
Otwiera się brama, ja nie wierzę oczom, czy jednak się rzeczy inaczej.
Just a few minutes after the song reached number one, it disappeared. The radio station Radio 3 allegedly deleted the song from their website and is being accused of censoring it because of its anti-government theme. The musician, Kajik, didn't exactly call out his target by name in his song, though it's pretty clear he's referring to Jarosław Kaczyński, the head of Poland's right-wing Law and Justice Party. Kaczyński had recently come under fire for visiting graves of his family members, breaking Poland's lockdown rules. Kajik sings, "You alone can soothe your pain. Everyone else goes down the drain."
Ból ukoić możesz ty jeden. Wszyscy inni wpadli w biedę. Limuzyny dwie, jedna, cały cmentarz twój. Lepszy niż mój. Na ulicach i w mieszkaniach.
One of the sadder consequences of this pandemic: worldwide, children are not getting enough to eat. When kids are in school, free lunches are a lifeline, but with schools closed, that can mean a child is not eating. Now a school in London is figuring out how to get food to their most vulnerable students. Reporter Brenna Daldorf in London has our story.
Okay, so let's find the lift. Was it the third floor? I think it was third, wasn't it? Okay, let's try third.
Fee Carrick-Davies, with her teenage son in tow, heads to the third floor of a high-rise apartment building in southeast London. They're carrying bagels and cereal to drop off with the family.
Miss Bola, I can't come in, my darling. I'm not allowed in.
Miss Bola is Bola Fegbemi. She has three kids. The youngest goes to Surrey Square Primary School, where Carrick-Davies works. This food delivery is part of the plan that Carrick-Davies and her colleagues cooked up to help their students while school is closed.
So we set up a really comprehensive list of every child or family in the school that we knew had some kind of vulnerability. That list at the moment stands at 133, I believe, families, about half of the school.
Many parents of Surrey Square students are immigrants and are blocked from federal help. That restriction is called No Recourse to Public Funds, or NRPF. That's the case for Fegbemi and her family. So when British officials started handing out grocery store gift cards to vulnerable families during the pandemic, Fegbemi's kids were left out. Even though they're UK citizens, the benefits ban applies to them too, including for the free lunches. staff at Surrey Square School decided to help.
One of my head teachers set up a fundraising page to provide vouchers for all our children with no recourse to public funds.
They also connected families with a food bank and started delivering some food themselves. Then, in April, staff at Surrey Square got some great news. UK officials decided to extend the school lunch voucher program to more kids, including those who'd been banned before.
Oh my goodness. I mean, we couldn't believe that this group of vulnerable children were being recognised, you know, and acknowledged and deemed valuable enough to support.
But when Carrick Davies and her colleagues looked closer at the guidelines, they realised only families who make less than £7,400 a year qualify. That's just $750 a month. It left a lot of families out.
Our parents who are working and have no recourse to public work really, really hard. They sometimes do 2-3 jobs, most of them, earning more than £7,400 a year. So they weren't eligible.
In the end, only one family at the school could get free meals under the extension. It wasn't Bola Fagbemi's family. They're barely scraping by. Fagbemi has essentially closed her childcare business. And now the family's only income is from her husband's job at a hospital, where he takes blood from COVID-19 patients. Her oldest daughter, Fatia, she's 13, says she worries about her dad.
I feel very petrified. We always make sure that we pray. We always thank God for what he's given us.
That includes the food from Surrey Square School and the people who rallied to help them. Fagbemi, the mom, still remembers when she first found out about the help.
I was crying that day because it's a good thing, you understand, like somebody just surprised you.
Her kids like the food that gets delivered, but not everything. Here's Fatia and her little sister, Aishat.
I'm not a fan of potato, but I've tried and learned to adapt with it because I need to appreciate what they've given us.
I actually don't mind them. I've always liked potatoes.
Right now, it's Ramadan. Fagbemi says that when the family breaks the fast each evening, they pause for a moment.
We count ourselves as among the lucky ones, you understand?
They know many other families aren't getting any help at all.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi.
For the world, Brenna Daldorf, London.
When was the last time you visited a museum? Yeah, me neither. The pandemic has kept art, natural history, and science shuttered away, and a new report warns many of those closings could be permanent. UNESCO and the International Council on Museums estimate that 13% of the world's museums may never reopen. Ernesto Otone is Assistant Director General for Culture at UNESCO. He joins us from Paris. So 13% sounds pretty dire. How bleak really is the picture?
You know, normally we should say that we'll try to get out of this crisis in a better way, shape. But it's not true. Right now, we have more than 95,000 museums in the world. During this pandemic, right now, we have more than 85,000 institutions that are closed. Not partially, completely closed.
Wow.
13% has answered that they don't know how to reopen their doors. Many museums have incomes that depend exclusively in the income of the visitors. And those museums, most of them, are closed for more than 3 months. They don't have any revenue during this period.
The United States, as you know, does not have a Secretary of Culture like a lot of countries. Are you seeing culture ministries in other countries stepping up to help museums? Or in a pandemic like this, do museums not rise to the level of essential bailouts right now?
In the world right now, you have only 22 countries that doesn't have Ministry of Culture. US is one of them. And what is important is that right now, national authorities are recognizing that museums are not only the building issue, it's also at the human level issue. I was director from some museum in my past, and I can assure you it's the first time that I hear national authorities that are reflecting not only on the institutional level, that it's very important that we know, but also at what is happening with the professionals that are working around cultural management, about artists, about creators, how this is affecting. Because at the end, it's the whole ecosystem.
You know, we've seen how people have turned to art during the pandemic as a source of comfort or joy, families recreating scenes from famous paintings at home, or people perform music on their rooftops. What is at stake here, Ernesto? What are we at risk of losing culturally if, like, one in eight museums around the world closes?
What we know is that people want to have cultural institutions. During this confinement, and you are living it right now in the US, we lived it in Europe, it was very important that creators, artists, intellectuals have made us through this crisis with a stronger voice, with a stronger advocacy about what is important. Well, those institutions as museums give us also some response about our identity and our heritage. And it's very important that we build around the society ways to support, however we can, to ensure that this transition of this new way of rethinking museum will happen with all the community around.
Ernesto Ottone is Assistant Director General for Culture at UNESCO. He's been speaking with us from Paris. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And stay safe.
I've got a gallery for you that's still open. Our stories at theworld.org, they're all on display. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Back with you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.